uniform. You jump hurriedly over the picture, and you plunge into the next story, noting that it is called The Crimsoned Emerald, and that, judging from the pictures, all the characters in it wear evening clothes all the time. Chug Skerrit took his dose of war with the best of them, but this is of Chug before and after taking. If inadvertently there should sound a faintly martial note, it shall be stifled at once with a series of those stylish dots, indicative of what the early Victorian writers conveniently called a drawn veil. Nothing could be fairer than that. Chug Skerrit was, and is, the proprietor and sole owner of the Elite Garage, and he pronounced it with a long I. Automobile parties touring Wisconsin used to mistake him for a handyman about the place and would call to him, "Hey boy, come here and take a look at this engine. She ain't hitting." When Chug finished with her, she was hitting all right. A medium-sized young fellow in the early 20s with a serious mouth, laughing eyes, and a muscular grace pretty well concealed by the grease-grimed grotesquerie of overalls. Out of the overalls, and in his tight-fitting belted green suit and long-visored green cap and flat russet shoes, he looked too young and insouciant to be the sole owner, much less the proprietor, of anything so successful and established as the Elite Garage. In a town like Chippewa, Wisconsin, or in any other sort of town for that matter, a prosperous garage knows more about the scandals of the community than does a barbershop, a dressmaker by the day, or a pool-room habitué. It conceals more skeletons than the catacombs. Chug Skerrit, had he cared to open his lips and speak, might have poured forth such chronicles as to make Spoon River sound a paean of sweetness and light. He knew how much old man Hatton's chauffeur knocked down on gas and repairs. He knew just how much the Tillotsons had gone into debt for their twin six, and why Emil Soder drove to Oshkosh so often on business, and who supplied the flowers for Mrs. McGurney's electric. Chug didn't encourage gossip in his garage. Whenever possible, he put his foot down on its ugly head in a vain attempt to crush it, but there was something about the very atmosphere of the place that caused it to thrive and flourish. It was like a combination newspaper office and Pullman car smoker. Chug tried to keep the thing down, but there might generally be seen lounging about the doorway or perched on the running board of an idle car a little group of slim, flat-heeled, low-voiced young men in form-fitting, high-waisted suits of that peculiarly virulent shade of green which makes its wearer look as if he had been picked before he was ripe. They were a lean, slim-flanked crew with a feline sort of grace about them, terse of speech, quick of eye, engine-wise, and generally nursing a boil just above the collar of their soft shirt. Not vicious, not even tough, rather bored, though they didn't know it, in their boredom resorting to the only sort of solace afforded boys of their class in a town of Chippewa size, cheap amusements, cheap girls, cheap talk. This last, unless the topic chanced to be of games or of things mechanical. Baseball, or a sweet running engine, brought out the best that was in them. At their worst, perhaps, they stood well back in the dim, cool shade of the garage doorway to watch how, when the girls went by in their thin summer dresses, the strong sunlight made a transparency of their skirts. At supper time, they would growl to their surprised sisters, "Put on some petticoats, you. Way you girls run around, it's enough to make a person sick." Chug Skerrit escaped being one of these by a double margin. There was his business responsibility on one side, his very early history on the other. Once you learn the derivation of Chug's nickname, you have that history from the age of 5 to 25 inclusive. Chug had been christened Floyd. She had got it out of a book, but it was an appendix rather than an appellation. No one ever dreamed of addressing him by that misnomer, unless you except his schoolteachers. Once or twice the boys had tried to use his name as a weapon, shrieking in a shrill falsetto and making two syllables of it. He put a stop to that soon enough with his fists and feet. His virility could have triumphed over a name twice as puerile. For that